You're listening to Manx Radio, and I'm Judith Lay, welcoming you to the podcast of The Manx Sky at Night with Howard Parkin.
The Nation Station, Manx Radio.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
And there is the familiar music that says Howard Parkin is in the studio, because it is time to welcome you to this month's edition of The Manx Sky at Night. And Howard, you must be a happy man, because we've changed the clocks and there's lots of dark sky.
Absolutely. Faster, my Judith. It's great to be here again. And the clocks have gone back, so the evenings are darker. And you know, we've had some good nights recently. We had a spell. I was away, and when I came back, we had that thick cloud cover for about 2 weeks. No stars at all. Then all of a sudden, last Tuesday. Last Monday, I was giving a talk to the farmers wildlife fair group out at Nocalo. And you know, we went outside stargazing, turned all the lights off, and it was absolutely superb. We actually managed to see the Milky Way with the naked eye, which is always something you can't see very easily, because the Milky Way is one of those things that you can't see with the naked eye unless it's really pitch black. And it was pitch black, and the Milky Way at the moment is stretching completely all the way across the sky, and you can't miss it. It goes all the way from the northwest right through to the southeast, and it really is a band of beautiful cloud. It looks like a cloud. People often think it's a cloud, but it's not. It's the Milky Way. It's the name of our galaxy. It's called the Milky Way, and the Milky Way, of course, is that band we see, named after milk spilt from a mother, from a baby's mouth when the baby bit the mother. And that's why it's called the Milky Way, which always surprises people. And we can see it quite spectacularly. But you can only see it when there's no moon around. So obviously you need to see it each side of the full moon, the new moon. So when we see it each side of the new moon, it can be quite special. The other thing we've got in the sky at the moment, of course, is, I won't say we're anticipating some decent aurora displays, but there's a chance of some aurora. We had the auroral peak. We think the peak was probably in May, June time. We're not certain for definite, but we think it was May, June. But what we've realised now is after the peak, you normally get some decent auroral displays, and we haven't had any. Not really. We've had a few little bits of aurora, but we haven't had a spectacular one like we had 12 months ago. So fingers crossed, we might get a decent display of aurora. If not now, because it is getting a bit past the auroral peak, which is around the equinoxes. So we might get another one around March time, just before the clocks go forward again.
Well, it is something to look forward to. I mean, we were so blown away with the first of them that we've been hoping.
Absolutely.
But you just to go down a little cul-de-sac for a moment. You have been away recently, haven't you, Howard? Seen the Northern Lights.
Oh yes, quite spectacularly. We were on the Queen Anne. I was on a cruise on the Queen Anne up from Southampton up to Norway and back, and you know, there's something about a ship when you're going to see the Northern Lights. I suspect it's the same with anybody who's on any sort of trip to the Northern Lights. There's a real sense of anticipation. Will we, won't we? Will we, won't we? And you can feel this round the ship. I gave a lecture the day before we got into Norwegian waters. I had 1,000 people there. It's the most record attendance I've ever had. Standing room only. I was amazed how many people were there to learn about the aurora. And, you know, the following, not that night, but the night after that, we saw some aurora. And the next day, the ship was just, I won't say it was happier, but there was a buzz about the place. Everyone had gone to see the Northern Lights and they'd all seen it. And it was spectacular. And you always will see it. If you're inside the Arctic Circle, you'll always see the Northern Lights, even at the minimum time. I say always, there have been times when I've not seen it, when I've been up there. But normally, you'll always see it if you're inside the Arctic Circle. And we saw it about 5 nights on the bounce, we saw it. And everyone was happy, and it was a great trip.
Well, that was the key to that trip particularly, wasn't it,
to see that? It was a Northern Lights trip, what it was all about.
Yep, so it would be good. I would guess that whether you've got 100 or 1,000 people doesn't really bother you.
It's immaterial. If I have 20, I've done, not on ships so much, but I've done talks to half a dozen people before now, and I've done talks to as I say, 1,000. My previous record was 700, but this really broke it. And I didn't realise, because of course when you're on stage doing anything in any form of performing activity, you've got spotlights straight in your eyes and you can't see it. And it was only when I looked down to the side, looking at my notes just to check something, I saw people standing in the aisles, and I thought, where have they all come from? And then I said to the AV technician who was looking up, I said, what was your number? He says, well, it seats 900, and you had more than that, so it must have been 1,000. I thought, wow.
But it shows that there was real interest, that people didn't just want to look at something beautiful. They wanted to understand what it was all about.
Indeed. And that's what it, and we planned it that way, but it would be my second lecture after we were on our way from Southampton up to so we're off the coast of Scotland, I suspect, when I gave this talk. But it was good, and I got such a buzz out of it. And of course, meeting people around the ship the next day, and I was on deck pointing out the Northern Lights to them, and shining my laser at the stars, you could see. It amazes me, because I can point out all the stars to people until the cows come home, but they're not interested. Well, never mind that, watch the aurora. The biggest tip I'll give to anybody, I gave this on the ship, how do you know it's aurora? Because you can see the stars through it. If it's clouds, you won't see the stars. If it's aurora, the stars will be seen through it just quite as clearly. And
right.
That is a true tip. Because we did have on that first night, we did have quite a bit of cloud around. And we were saying, is that aurora? Is that aurora? I said, no, that's cloud. How do you know? You can't see the stars for it. And then, of course, the next night when we had no clouds in Tromso, and there was hardly any clouds whatsoever, and the aurora was spectacular, and you could see the stars of Pegasus and things like that through the aurora. So that's a tip for anyone who goes Northern Light spotting. If you can see stars, it's definitely aurora.
But the other quick tip that was given out at the time was that if you hold your camera up to it, your phone up with the camera on it.
Just take a very quick picture. It doesn't matter if it'll blurry or anything else, but if it turns green, if it shows green on the screen, it is definitely aurora.
Yeah.
Keep looking.
I thought you were going to say keep dancing there, Howard. Right, let's get back to our skies and what we can look forward to in the coming weeks.
Well, I always like this time of the year, not just because the clocks go back and it's got darker earlier, because the autumn is a real sense of anticipation, a bit like my aurora bit. It's a real sense of anticipation because you haven't got many very bright stars in the sky. We have got, at the moment in the night sky, we've got the planet Saturn just below the square of Pegasus, which if you looked south or southeast, depending on what time you're looking around, 10 o'clock at night, you will see an object on its own quite bright. That is the planet Saturn. Now, Saturn is always great to see through a telescope or a pair of binoculars because you can see the rings. Unfortunately, the rings are more or less edge on to us next month, so we're not going to see the rings very clearly. But it is still a spectacular sight to see. And it looks like a little tiny yellowy disk. And just above it is a group of stars known as the Square of Pegasus, which I mentioned last month, actually. And the Square of Pegasus is the feature in the sky in the constellation of Pegasus, the winged horse. And the Square of Pegasus to the right of it, sorry, the left of it, we've got the constellation there of Andromeda and the Andromeda galaxy. And last Tuesday, Monday, I keep saying Tuesday, last Monday when I was doing the talk to the farmers, we were able to see the Milky Way and we could see the Andromeda galaxy just about visible to the naked eye. And that is pretty good because, again, I mentioned before about the horrible cloudy weather we had when we could just have a blanket of cloud engulfing the Isle of Man for days and days, it seemed to me. When we got a clear night last Monday, it was the first night, as I say, I'd seen the sky myself for some time. When we saw the sky and we saw the stars, it was great, but there was a lot of water vapour in the atmosphere. You could tell it was still very damp. So that meant that the seeing, what we call the seeing, wasn't good. But even so, we could still see the Milky Way and we could just about make out Andromeda, which is always a target for me to see. Very difficult to point out to somebody without if they don't know what they're looking at, but Andromeda at 2.3 million light years away is the best thing or the furthest thing you'll ever see with your naked eyes.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, we come back to this age-old thing that even if you don't know what you're seeing, as long as you can stop and be awestruck by what
absolutely.
Is whatever it is in the sky.
Yeah.
It is. I do feel a huge sense of satisfaction, though, if I can look up and think, ooh, that might be Jupiter, you know, or something like that.
Well, the other great thing is people will say to me, and they do this, and I forget this one until I'm outside stargazing and I sort of forget about it again, but people say to me, well, where are all these stars? And I say, every single star you see in the sky is in the Milky Way galaxy. They're all in our home galaxy. We do not see stars from any other galaxy. The only other thing we see that's not in our galaxy is the Andromeda galaxy with the naked eye. That is a galaxy in its own right. Every other star is in our local galaxy. And we reckon with the naked eye, you can see about 3,000 stars. So 3,000, that's nothing when you consider the total number of stars in our Milky Way. So when you do look up and you see this band, this light band across the sky, if it is the Milky Way, and this is the best time of the year to see it, because I can't stress enough, it really goes straight overhead, literally, from northeast to southwest. And almost directly overhead is the star Deneb in the constellation of Cygnus, which we use as another sign. Just enjoy it. And if you can make out the Milky Way and Saturn, well, hey, you're on your way.
So what else have we got to look forward to this month, Howard?
Well, the other morning, because the clocks hadn't gone back on Friday, I think it was, we had a beautiful morning on Friday, and lo and behold, about 7 o'clock in the morning, absolutely brilliant in the eastern sky before sunrise, was the planet Venus. Very, very easy to see. And completely the other direction to it, almost on the western horizon, you could still make out the planet Jupiter. So we've got Saturn in the evening sky, we've got Jupiter and Venus in the morning sky, and we've got Mars going around the back of the sun at the moment, so we're not going to see Mars. So plenty to see, plenty to look at. And I hate to mention this, but no doubt it's going to be all over the media on the 4th or the 5th of November when it is. We have a supermoon coming up. We have a supermoon coming up in November. The full moon in November is a supermoon. Means the moon is ever so slightly bigger than normal. But what I want to tell people is it's the 5th of November night. There you go. But what I say to everybody is, don't take my word for it. It isn't massive, huge, with the Tower of Refuge in front of it, and it's massive. Hold your arm at arm's length with your little finger, and your little fingernail will cover the full moon. No matter where you're looking, when you're looking, it will always cover the full moon. The moon is half a degree wide. It is 13% bigger when it's a supermoon than when it's a wimpy moon. When it's smaller because of its orbit, and you won't see 13% difference in a half a degree with your fingernail. That's it.
I think the difficulty, and I feel, my heart goes out to you in a way, Howard, because what you say is all the things you're saying is technically correct. However, when a clever photographer takes a beautiful picture that's got a national landmark in front of it, be it the Eiffel Tower, Statue of Liberty, or whatever, and they get at a certain angle, and the moon does look very, very big,
but it's
and it's
totally
and it's
false.
Very, but yeah, but it's very beautiful. But it's very beautiful.
Yeah, but it's two pictures. The landmark will be one picture. The moon will be superimposed on the back of it. It's not one photograph. You cannot take a picture of a monument like that with a full moon behind it big. It's Photoshop.
No, I completely understand.
And that's what frustrates astrophotographers. Yeah. We like to take pictures of what you can actually see with the camera, admittedly, like the aurora or whatever. But when you start messing around and making things bigger to make it look attractive from an artistic point of view, well, you might as well paint it.
Well, people do that as well.
Well, that's more acceptable to
them. Let's move on.
I think we should.
Let's move on.
The other thing we've got in the sky at the moment, of course, is we've got three comets. It's like buses, you never find them, and then you get three at once. We've got Comet Lemon, Comet Swan, and Comet Atlas at the moment. Now, Comet Lemon is just about visible to the naked eye. I mentioned before about looking at the Andromeda galaxy with the naked eye. Well, Comet Lemon is a little bit brighter than that. And Comet Lemon is easily found if you know where the plough is, if you can find the plough. And you've got to wait till around midnight when the plough is sort of turned round from lying on the bottom of the northern horizon to standing upright with its tail pointing down. That star, I often talk about, you follow the arc of the handle of the plough down to the star Arcturus. Well, that's where this comet is. It's just between the constellation of Ursa Major, or the plough, it's between the two, and tracking in a left-hand direction, towards the left. It's very faint, very difficult to spot, but there's been loads of pictures put on the websites recently, and Facebook and all sorts of places, of it seen from bad ahead and places like that. So it's worth looking out for. It's a comet that's just about visible, as I say, with the naked eye. And it was at its best on the 21st of October. Now it's slowly pulling away from us. Comet Swan, I'm afraid, is another one, but it's very close to the sun. And therefore, the horizon, I should say, the sunlit horizon, so very difficult to spot. But Comet Atlas is another one of these interstellar comets. It's a comet that's come from outside of our solar system, and it's winging its way through the solar system. It's never going to be naked eye brightness, but it's fascinating to realise that this object, which the James Webb Telescope has been looking at, they've detected all sorts of component parts of this, which show that ices and the things that comets we think brought the water to the Earth all those billions of years ago are prevalent not just in our solar system from the comets that come from our solar system, or the Oort cloud or whatever, but they come from outside our solar system as well. So it makes us realise that the building blocks of life are not rare, if you like, in the universe, which begs the question, is life able to evolve anywhere else?
Well, that is...
Which I'm not going to answer.
No, but it's an ongoing question, and it comes back under the heading of the more we know, the more we realise we don't
absolutely
know.
Absolutely right.
We have still to discover. The International Space Station.
Yeah, I've just started my night school classes, and one of the questions I always get asked when I do my night school classes, are you going to take us out and show us the stars and show us the space station? Well, this year I thought I'd give them a break, give them a few classroom lessons first for the first few weeks. The International Space Station will be visible in the evening skies from the Isle of Man from the 13th of November right through to the end of November. And because the clocks have gone back, because it's dark earlier, you always get them around 6, 7 o'clock at night, 7, 8 o'clock maybe, and maybe two passes in one night. Very easy to spot, very unmistakable. You can't miss it when you do see it. But the actual dates, times and directions, it always goes from west to east. And it varies in height between just above the horizon to about 55 degrees high. So always well worth looking out for. And if you want full details of that, just put ISS visibility from the Isle of Man, and there's loads of websites will take you to it. Or you can use the Heavens Above website, which is the one I always use.
Is this music that I can hear in the background?
Yes, thank you,
now,
Judith.
Now, what I'd like to know is, what I'm Just a Singer in a Rock and Roll Band has got to do with the Manx Sky at Night?
It's the it's my favourite band.
Is the correct answer.
Absolutely.
Space news after our music break.
Thank you.
It is a great track, but
absolutely,
we've got lots of things to talk about, so
indeed
I'm just going to fade that one out there. But come on, Howard, there is a very special reason that...
There is indeed, Judith. The Moody Blues, as I say, I've been a fan of the Moody Blues since the 60s, and they're just my favourite band. And of course, sadly, John Lodge died only a few days ago now, and he was the lead vocalist on that particular track, so I just thought how appropriate to play that. And yes, they do some tracks that have got cosmic references in, so maybe we'll play one of them another time.
We have had a message in. Chris has been listening to you talking about photographs that might be photoshopped, and he sent in a picture of the three of the clangers on the moon. And he said, really, Howard, you'll be telling me next that this isn't a real photograph.
But the clangers are real. And
of
the
course they
real,
are.
So, no, no, that one is a genuine photograph, I'm sure.
That's a relief. Now, let us move on. You're listening to this month's edition of The Manx Sky at Night with Howard Parkin. And as we always do after our music break, we now move from our Manx skies to space news. So what's the top story this month, Howard?
I pick one from about 20, I'm afraid. I can't believe it. I mean, at this time of the year, when I start my night school again, I sort of pick the thread up again and start looking more and more detailed into the stories. And there's just so much going on. November the 9th, we've got to look forward to the launch of the New Glenn rocket with the new NASA Escapade mission. That's going to be launching on, as I say, on November the 9th. So that's the hot news for the next few weeks. That'll be something we'll cover. Hopefully, it'll be launched successfully on November the 9th. But, of course, Starship, Elon Musk, he gets a lot of stick these days, this poor Elon, but his Starship 11 launch, which took place early October, was like Starship 10, complete and utter success. The spacecraft was launched, all the rockets fired successfully, they managed to turn them off, turn them back on again, they did what they call a hot staging manoeuvre, they brought the Starship back down into the Indian Ocean, they brought the booster back down into the Gulf of Mexico, everything was like clockwork, it went completely as planned. And now they're moving on to the next generation Starship, which is this was the last of the previous generation. I think that was generation 2. I could be wrong on that. I think the next one is 3. And that is going to be launched not probably till late this year or possibly early next year, I suspect, because it's a brand new rocket. It's the same basic rocket, but obviously it's more updated and everything else. Because the main thing is that the actual Starship, which sits on top of the heavy booster, the actual Starship is being planned to be the rocket that lands the people on the moon in the Artemis 3 mission, which is going to take place probably 28-29. And the lander is meant to be a Starship. Well, NASA only a few days ago announced that they're not waiting just for Starship anymore. Now they're asking Blue Origins, which is Jeff Bezos, another millionaire. You've got Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. And they're now going to open it up that maybe they'll use the Blue Origins lunar lander. So a bit of pressure being put onto Mr. Musk there. And of course, this is all being done because the Chinese are on the way to the moon. Well, they're not on the way today, but they do reckon that the Chinese are planning a mission to the moon as well. And the space race is hotting up again between America and China so much this time. So we'll just have to wait and see, but it's all fascinating.
I was just going to say that the space race is hotting up, but the difference now is rather than countries with their own space program, we've got so much private, and in fact, more as equally as much, if not more, private involvement, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. It's funny you should say that, because when I was on the ship the other day, a lady had a Q&A session in the ship, and you do it, and someone said to me, why are we spending all this money on space? Shouldn't we be spending the money elsewhere? And I think we've touched on this topic before. And my answer to anyone who says that is, what are we spending the money on? We're spending it on research, development, employment, jobs, security, education, everything. The money isn't being launched into space. The money is being used to further the development of mankind and its exploration. Yes, you could channel that money into something else. But I think I've also mentioned before the fact that Americans spend more on cosmetics than they do on the space program. But we won't go into that in too much detail with ladies present.
No, let's not. But I can see the lady's point. I mean, we've said ourselves that more and more space stories are in the news because a lot of it is private enterprise and huge amount of money being poured into it. And I can see how, yes, I know that the developments that they make do help us in medicine and all kinds of things and industry and the experiments and what they learn do have a payback for the things that we're doing, as you might say, on Earth. But it does seem a massive amount of activity, more than ever, and a massive amount of money.
That's engineering. I mean, you could say the same of the internet. You could say the same of all this stuff we're doing with AI, like it or not. People always want to spend the money on, what should I call, the sexy things. Yes, if you've got a limited amount of money as a government to spend, maybe you should spend it on other things like medicine or housing or whatever. But that's not the way the world works. People will always want to explore. They'll always want to push the envelope of technology. Heaven forbid, war is the biggest growth of technology in the world. When they have a war, the technological increases are dramatic. Did you know yesterday was the anniversary of the first launch of a rocket that took a picture of the Earth from space?
I did not know that, Howard.
It was a V2. It was after the war, they launched a V2 from New Mexico to see how they worked and everything else, and it took a camera and took a picture of the Earth. First ever picture of the space was taken from a V2 rocket.
I thought
it was very poignant, I thought, really.
Yeah, it is. And I think that if we were to go back such a long time, we'd find that was a lot of experimentation was done, but it was done quietly.
Yeah.
It was just, let's see, by people who had the imagination to see perhaps this technology could do this. Let's just try it. But they didn't have a big fanfare.
It's all in the news, isn't it?
Everything. Yes. Yeah, it is. There's an awful lot here that we could unpack, because I think also there's quite a lot that we perhaps don't hold the same views.
Exactly. But that's what it's all about. You're meant to agree to differ. That's the trouble of the world these days. People can't agree to have different opinions. It's my opinion or nobody's, but hey, we won't get into philosophy.
No, let's not. We haven't got too much time.
I will give you one story which has got a political bias to it, though, because the President Trump made a decree about a year ago now, or just after he became president. They've decided to move the Space Shuttle Discovery from the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. to Houston Manned Space Flight Center. That was the decree from the president. The Smithsonian aren't happy about this at all, as you can understand. And they've actually said to NASA and to the government, we can't move it without chopping it up into pieces. And it's going to cost us, $15 million to move it to Houston? And the Smithsonian are basically saying, we're not moving it. And the government's saying, yes, you are. We're a privately funded museum. No, you get government money. You're going to do it. Well, if we have to do it, we've got to chop it up. Which begs the question, if they got it in there without cutting it up, why can't they get it out again without cutting it up? Personally, I think it should stay where it is. It's a national museum and all the rest, but it's one of those political stories that affects the space industry. And the money for that is a waste of money, moving it, because they've got a perfectly a decent replica shuttle at the Johnson Space Center. The one that they should have moved was Atlantis, which is in California. But hey, what am I to say? I don't have anything to do with American politics. But it's a real story that's running and running at the moment, and who knows where it's going to go to. Smithsonian say no, hanging on to it. Houston say no, we want it. And the government saying, give it to them. So let's wait and see. My bet is it won't get moved. My bet is they'll turn around and say it's going to cost them far too much money, and they'll build them something else. They'll build them another rocket or something today. I don't know.
Well, you're the man that's got the inside track on these things, Howard. I would always bow to your opinion on it. Right, OK. If you had to pick one story to finish off now, what would it be? Would it be commercial space stations?
It would be commercial space stations, because this was something I wasn't particularly aware of, because I know there is a space station going to be launched, the International Space Station, in the next 3 or 4 years, the Axiom space station. And what they're going to do with that, they're going to launch a space station in modules, dock it to the International Space Station, and then when the space station is past its sell-by date and they're going to deorbit it, they're going to detach their space station, the Axiom space station, and it'll be the world's first commercial space station. No, a company called VAST have just finished the building of their own Harmony spaceship module, and that is going to get launched, hopefully, at the end of 2026-7, and that will be the first private space station to go into orbit. Following on from that, there are two or three other companies looking at doing that. There was a company called Bigelow who made an inflatable module that's actually attached to the International Space Station way back in about 2018. Sadly, in COVID, Bigelow went bust, and therefore they can't. That's not progressing. But this new idea, these two companies now, the VAST company and Axiom, are vying to get a space station into orbit in the very near future. And yes, you've guessed it, there are going to be people, fare-paying passengers, going to go into space and stay in this orbital outpost. And again, I got asked the question about space flight and when we're going to go into space and it's too expensive. It's just like aviation was 100 years ago. Aviation was the thing of the rich, or the daring barnstormers, and now we all fly everywhere. And it's going to be the same with spaceflight, I suspect, in about the next 50 years, including, if you look at the statistics of it and the mechanics of it, getting a plane, a suborbital space plane, which will take you to Australia in about 6 hours.
Well, this is being held as the carrot, isn't it?
That's the big commercial goal.
It's very difficult for us to see the benefits of hanging in space in the darkness
gravity,
of space.
Yeah.
But just exactly to experience the novelty of zero gravity. But if it shrinks the world, this
very
is
much.
What people are interested in. Howard, as ever, an endless supply of things for us to talk about.
So.
And we have, as always, been beaten by the clock, which is a good way to be. I can't ever see us running out of topics.
I don't think we can. I looked at this morning when I got the list ready to talk to you about, and I thought, I've got to talk about that, I've got to talk about that, I've got to talk about that.
And you did.
We've just about got them all in.
Howard,
what we didn't get in, we'll do next month.
Howard, I shall look forward to it. You'll be back the final Sunday in the month of November with more stories from near and far. Howard Parkin, Fastamai.
Fastamai, Judith.